From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dratzer in New York. Mark Sloboda is still on vacation and will be back next week. Eric, Happy New Year. Too bad we don't have Mark with us to wish him the same, but he'll be back next week, and we're glad to have you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Don. Happy New Year to you. Best to your family. Best for 2016. Let's get into it.
Yeah, so we said we'd start in Africa, so let's start in Africa. I think Nigeria might be a good place to start.
Sure, yeah. I mean, we were mentioning last week we wanted to get to Africa and didn't get a chance to, and so many different things happening in Africa. I mean, we would probably need to spend this week and next week and the week after trying to unpack all of it, but Nigeria seems to be the flashpoint. Nigeria seems to be, sort of the hot spot where a number of different interests, both regionally and continentally and, of course, globally, seem to be converging. I think the biggest news out of Nigeria of the last month or so is probably what a lot of people have already heard about. It is the killing of Sheikh Zakzaki's family and many of his followers in the Islamic movement in Nigeria. And this has obviously made international headlines because Zakzaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria are backed by Iran, and they are Shia in a country that is divided between Christians and Muslims, who are almost, I don't know exactly the percentage, but I think it's more than 95% Sunni in Nigeria's north. So it's a complicated ethnic and religious situation or makeup in Nigeria. And within that sort of complicated ethnic map, you have this Islamic movement led by this guy, Sheikh Zakzaki, who is traditionally pretty much unanimously understood to be very, very close to the political and religious establishment in Iran. Now, his followers were more or less massacred. I mean, that's the word I think that needs to be used here. Massacred by the Nigerian military, 3 weeks ago now, I think. There are certainly questionable circumstances surrounding this case. What exactly set off the killing of Zakzaki's family and followers? Was it what the government alleges, which is that a military convoy with a high-ranking, I think it was a general, a high-ranking official nonetheless, attacked by followers of the Islamic movement, and that in returning fire, they killed X number of people? That's, of course, the story of the government. The Zakzaki side, the Islamic movement side, basically says that this was a targeted massacre designed to wipe out their group, to wipe out Shia in Nigeria. Now, this is the basic narrative. This is how it's developing, and this is how it's being propagated internationally. But I don't really want to wade into that morass in the sense of, look, I'm not Muslim. I have no dog in the fight when it comes to sectarian issues, sectarian strife. As far as I'm concerned, sectarianism is fomented by the imperialists for the purpose of divide and rule. So, I don't really play into the sectarian side of this angle. What I'm mostly interested in is the regional and the global geopolitics behind all of this, because I don't think these things happen in a vacuum. Now, I don't know, Don, if you want to interject. I don't want to hog the mic here.
Just a point here for people to understand. In Nigeria, the Muslim community was almost exclusively Sunni, and the Shias that are there are converts that Zakzaki has led, and particularly young people from the urban areas. And he has claimed, and he shows strength along these lines, that he can pull 1 million people into the street. So it's a pretty powerful political force as well.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the extent to which it's an element of Iranian foreign policy is probably a subject of debate. I think that Zakzaki and his followers and, you know, his sort of, you know, followers around the world or sympathizers around the world would say that he's simply a man of peace, a unifier, not a proxy of the Iranian government. Obviously, there are elements inside of Nigeria and certainly elements around the Arab world, the Sunni Arab world especially, which would argue the opposite, that Zakzaki's movement is entirely controlled by the Iranian government, by Tehran, and that it is, in effect, a proxy, an aspect of their foreign power projection. So I think that this is really the way that we need to examine this issue, is the extent to which Zakzaki is, in effect, a proxy of Iran, and more importantly, if we're to accept that that premise, and certainly not everyone does, but if we're to accept that premise, then the attack on Zakzaki is in effect part of a broader war, proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's my contention here. Yeah,
yeah. On that very point, the claims that Zakzaki is an Iranian, agent in one fashion or another, of course, come from a Sunni hierarchy that has Saudi Arabia's hands all over it. So in effect, you have Saudi Arabia accusing him of being Iranian.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's both sides there.
Exactly. There's no doubt about that. And you know, the Qataris and the Saudis got proxies all over West Africa, all throughout the Sahel, all over North Africa. So that's kind of what I'm getting at here, is whether or not you accept Zakzaki as, you know, agent of the Iranians is sort of a moot point. The Saudis certainly do. And the Iranians have certainly, and, you know, Shias internationally have certainly rallied around the Zakzaki cause. So even if the Islamic movement is not an Iranian proxy, it's certainly in the propaganda sphere operating as, in the sphere of Iran. And that's really, again, I'm not wanting to make an argument one way or the other about that per se. Certainly we could debate that endlessly, probably. Sure. What I'm most interested in is the global implications of what we're seeing here, because it seems to me that the Saudis have been put, and the Qataris as well, have been pushing very strongly all throughout the Sahel and West Africa to increase their influence, to grow their influence. And I think that a reasonable argument could be made, and I certainly would not discount it, that the move against Zakzaki was driven by the Saudis and or the Qataris for the purposes of dealing a blow to Iranian power projection in light of Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey increasingly losing in Syria. See, this is where I think these issues are connected, where the Saudis and the other Gulf, the reactionary feudal monarchies of the Gulf, where their mission in Syria is collapsing and they're losing, they look to approach the global proxy war against Iran from another angle, from another direction. Right. And I think that's what Zakzaki is. And I know we're going to get to it in a minute, but I think that that's also part of the motivation for the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr in Saudi Arabia. Again, this is the way that the Wahhabi Saudis are sending a message to the Iranians that they should not believe that just because they're winning in Syria, that they are actually winning the global proxy war. And remember, West Africa factors centrally into the foreign policy of both the United States and its NATO allies, the former colonial powers on the one hand, and China, and to a lesser degree, but increasingly so, Russia as well. So there is also the largest, call it macro level of geopolitics here, wherein the United States and NATO on the one hand, Russia, China on the other hand, Nigeria, of course, becoming increasingly a proxy battlefield.
Yeah, and you know, there's a couple of things nested in there that are important. I think maybe we could blow out a little bit. First is, the demonstrative value of taking out Zakzaki isn't only for the benefit of the elite in Iran and those watching, but also inside Saudi Arabia. because yes. the king has been besieged by people inside the royal family, and he has to show some victory somewhere because they've been calling for him to step down or worse. You know, sometimes heads roll there as a part of that project. The other is, if you look at the ongoing Saudi and Qatari project, take it back to the NATO bombing coverage in Libya that essentially was the air force for Qatari and Saudi-backed and Qatari-commanded takeover of Libya. And that happened simultaneously with the beginning of the war in Syria. And also you had the revolution turned Muslim Brotherhood election turned military coup in Egypt. You had sort of thrust parry thrust in Egypt. So, as they went into the entire North African region, if you actually, hold a map in your head while you do it, and you look at Syria, Egypt, Libya, and then points west and south from Libya, it's part of the same war.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think you're absolutely right. And of course, you and I have talked about it. I've written about, the flow of weapons and the flow of fighters out of Libya and how that impacted everything that happened in Mali, how that's impacted everything that's happened in Chad, how that was a direct antecedent to the source of the growth of Boko Haram, which is, of course, central to a lot of what's happening in Nigeria right now. So absolutely, there are a number of ramifications from the war on Libya, and you're again absolutely.
Let me add one other thing in there, because actually, as an opening salvo to the war on Libya, which also, by the way, opened the continent up to AFRICOM, which is now firmly entrenched, was the insurgent war against the government in Cote d'Ivoire, which yes. ended up with the French takeover of Cote d'Ivoire and the installation of Ouattara, who comes out of the IMF.
Right, and that is what really allowed the French the sort of the, if I could be allowed to use the pun, the gall, get it? The gall to have the intervention in Mali. Of course, exactly. The French in Mali were essentially reasserting their colonial rule using the terrorism as the pretext, terrorism which was directly precipitated by the French-participated NATO bombardment of Libya. So absolutely. I mean, all signs go back to Libya as really the starting point for a lot of this. But to bring it back to the point you were making, which is an absolutely critical one, Don, and I'm really glad you made it, that really the Qatari and Saudi footprint can also be, and especially the Qatari footprint, can also be directly attributed to Libya, because, of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the various al-Qaeda elements that were used to overthrow and to murder Gaddafi and to destroy the country, they were all on the payroll of the Qataris and the Saudis, with the Qatari Air Force literally being, the Qataris being in command, as Al Jazeera reported it in 2011. Yeah. So, there's a number of factors here to point us in the direction when it comes to Zakzaki and Nigeria, that again, what we're seeing is obviously a move by the Saudis and or the Qataris to push back against Iran in the region and to show that they are the dominant power there when it comes to the countries from the Arab and Muslim world. Now, obviously, nothing happens in Africa without the United States. Nothing happens without the consideration of the larger geopolitical implications for the United States and NATO on the one hand, and China on the other hand. And of course, Nigeria is a central aspect of Chinese economic strategy for all of Africa, and equally so, Nigeria is a major oil producing cash cow for the West. And so there are a lot of larger implications here. Now, let me throw one other thing to complicate this matter even further. There's another issue, besides Boko Haram, besides the killing of Zakzaki, that people need to watch, and it's very underreported. You almost read nothing about it, and that is ethnic strife, ethnic conflict that is being fomented by the United States for the purposes of breaking up the country. Because on the one hand, I think a lot of people know that there is a division in Nigeria between the North and the South, the North being Muslim, the South being Christian. I think this is pretty well known, pretty well understood by most people who follow these issues. But what many people miss is that there are also major conflicts between the larger ethnic groups in the country, in particular the Yoruba people. The Yoruba ethnic group has traditionally been very, let's say, if not resistant, then certainly uneasy about the federalized system that exists in Nigeria. They have long since been agitating for increased autonomy. And based on my own research over the course of the last couple of years, I could tell you that the United States is busy fomenting precisely that thinking, using former Nigerian generals who are well wealthy landowners of the Yoruba ethnic group to essentially agitate for Yoruba independence. Now, I'm not old enough, of course, to remember this, but Don, I think you would, and certainly people of your generation would, the Biafra War. And the Biafra War was essentially exactly what I just described, this ethnic war in regards to the Yoruba people and potential independence. Now, if we see simultaneously the growth of Boko Haram, the growing division between Muslim and Christian, growing sectarian divides within the Muslim community, and on top of that, Yoruba agitation for independence, well, we know where this is all going. This is going towards the breakup and or balkanization of Nigeria, something that many people in the imperial establishment have long since talked about, that Nigeria was quote-unquote unsustainable, that this was a country that was, you know, quote-unquote just barely held together and so forth. That type of talk, I think, really reinforces what I believe is the U.S. strategy in Nigeria, which is ultimately, if not to break it up formally, then to break it up de facto in order to deprive China of one of its main trading partners on the African continent.
And Nigeria is also an entree into the next tier BRICS-like groups, the so-called MINT groups. You have Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and I don't know how, but Turkey. Three of those, you know, great oil reserves, Mexico and Indonesia also have an awful lot of petroleum. And, you know, if you can work the members of those countries from the inside, as certainly they have done with Mexico.
Yeah, exactly.
Certainly, you look at Turkey is also going through similar stresses. And Indonesia's had that kind of tension, you know, going back to the 1960s.
It's a great point, Don, and let me just say this too. Remember that Mexico, under the right-wing Peña Nieto government, Mexico is doing exactly what the United States corporations have been dictating that they do, namely privatizing all of the energy production in the country, or as much of it as they can. This privatization push in Mexico is one of the reasons why Mexico has looked upon favorably by the United States. On the contrary, Nigeria has really refused to accept the diktats of the United States when it comes to energy production, and have been looking increasingly at China as an economic outlet for some of the investment that they need. Remember, when we're talking about Nigeria, we're not talking about, you know, the, you know, one of these bottom tier in terms of GDP, in terms of economics, bottom tier African countries. Nigeria is a massive country with a massive population, a very, very vibrant market for goods, whether they're Western goods, whether they're Chinese-made goods, a huge country with massive potential for infrastructure investment, infrastructure development, precisely the kind of investment that China likes to make, advanced communication systems, satellite communication systems, and so forth. Nigeria is one of the most advanced economies in Africa, certainly on par with a lot of other countries around the world. And so Nigeria is no small prize here.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at almost 200 million people population, or about 20% of the population of the continent in that small area.
That's right.
A GDP over $1 trillion.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2/3 of the population of the United States, and it's a country that is really pivotal for the entire course of Africa. I think a very solid argument could be made that Nigeria is the single most important country in Africa, with all due respect to South Africa and to Egypt, I think. But, you know, again, this question of Nigeria, Zakzaki, all of this fits into a broader narrative, a narrative of neocolonialism from the United States and its proxies, and then secondarily, or maybe primarily, I don't know, whatever, but secondarily, this larger proxy war between the Saudis, Qataris on the one hand, and the Iranians on the other. I think that is really how we need to understand this Zakzaki massacre issue. Now, there's a couple of questions that I don't think we're going to get answers to, at least not yet. Who got paid here? I think that's a very real question. Is there an element inside? Because I don't believe that the Nigerian president, President Buhari, sanctioned this. I think that that would be I think that that would be probably unlikely, considering that Buhari ran on a law and order platform, basically suggesting that he was going to bring peace to the north of Nigeria, that he was going to not only resolve the Boko Haram issue with military strength, but that he was going to essentially placate as best as possible the entire north of the country. But does that mean that Buhari ordered this? I suppose it's possible, but I tend to lean towards probably not. Now, the general involved, the high-ranking military officials, it's entirely possible that Saudi money changed hands or Qatari money changed hands. Somebody got paid to carry out a massacre against the Islamic movement. I think that is quite likely. And again, unfortunately, as we know with the entire post-colonial history, both in Africa and in Latin America, many of these military officials, high-ranking military officials, have direct links to the U.S. military, either through receiving U.S. military training or through joint exercises, joint cooperation, many different ways, you know, quote-unquote special advisors of the rest of the things that the United States does. All of these various ways, I think, again, point to this broader geopolitical conflict.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, now it's fairly direct with AFRICOM, you know, which is essentially a command and control device that unifies to a large degree, militaries of the continent. Just this one other thing I wanted to throw out there, because, current president took office just in the last year and a half. I forget when he came in.
No, less than that. I think it was a change.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a change in direction. It was the political call for a change in direction in any event. And previously, if you go back to the beginning of the crisis in Cote d'Ivoire that led to the ouster of the president there, Gbagbo, Nigeria, which is a dominant power inside ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, which was intervening then, was intervening on the side of Ouattara and basically in alliance with France against the leftist government in Cote d'Ivoire. So the foreign policy of Nigeria at the time, although there have been ambiguities in it, seemed allied with the West, at least in terms of policy towards Cote d'Ivoire.
Well,
and perhaps, you know, there was a change, at least symbolically, with the new administration.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because this is something that we've seen on the African continent in a few different places. Specifically, in my mind, Ethiopia, where you have a country that is in many ways very much a lapdog of the United States, of the West, sort of their, you know, cop on the beat for the region, so to speak. You know, Nigeria being the dominant player in West Africa, Ethiopia being the dominant player in East Africa, the Horn of Africa. And so, yes, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. But as with Ethiopia, Nigeria as well has increasingly been looking at China, increasingly been trying to develop, I guess, the rudiments of what could be called a multi-vector foreign policy. Now, when a puppet state or a client state or a proxy state begins to explore the multi-vector foreign policy avenue, that sets off alarm bells in Washington. Washington and in London and in Brussels, because, of course, they see their position increasingly slipping there. And I think that that's precisely what we've seen in Nigeria. And I don't mean to segue too quickly, but I think that's also what we're seeing in Burundi.
Yeah. And then, of course, it's a member of what's now called the Commonwealth of Nations, but the British Commonwealth.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, and a lot of these issues in Africa, as I think we should expect, a lot of them have their roots in the legacy of colonialism on the African continent. And I just mentioned Burundi, of course. Burundi, like Rwanda, its neighbor, a former Belgian colony in Africa in the Great Lakes region, one that has lived with the legacy of the Tutsi-Hutu divide, which has really sort of, I think, been the principal conflict in the Great Lakes region. And what we're seeing in Burundi now is a major push by the West, by the United States, by the empire against the embattled government in Burundi, because it has dared to assert some level of sovereignty and independence. And, you know, for people who haven't been following the situation in Burundi, basically earlier in 2015, the president of Burundi, President Nkurunziza, Nkurunziza basically wanted to have a chance at another term in office. Now, the constitution as written it mandates no more than two terms, and this is now the end of Nkurunziza's second term. However, the Supreme Court in that country ruled that because Nkurunziza was not elected to his first term, he was the first president post-peace accords with the new constitution, so he was appointed and then only elected for one term after that. He's actually technically only been elected once, and so he wanted a chance to be elected a second time, which would technically be a third term, but really only a second elected term. Now, this legal ambiguity, this has now been seized upon by the entire NGO establishment in the West. In particular, Amnesty International has been out in the lead on this, but also Avaaz.org and some of the others have been, I think Soros's International Crisis Group also, they have been pushing very hard to portray Nkurunziza as some kind of a dictator trying to seize control of Burundi, trying to destroy the Tutsi minority. You know, it's the same old story. They retread it over and over again in the Great Lakes region. Now, obviously, I think anybody who knows, you know, the politics of Africa, the politics of that region, should understand that that is, in effect, a smokescreen, a cover for a much larger geopolitically and strategically important issue, namely the influence and control of the United States and its regional proxies on the one hand versus the emerging powers of the BRICS on the other hand. This theme crops up over and over again when talking about Africa. And it's central when we're talking about Burundi. Now, there's a few angles to this that need to be understood. Don, I don't know. I don't mean to hog the mic if
you
want to.
That's all right. There's something first, just a little context for people.
Yeah, that's Burundi, what I wanted to. Yep.
Burundi, it sits between Rwanda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, and very close to Uganda, and across the lake from Kenya. Now, if you think about all of the activity, the military, you know, the uprisings, the fighting, the terrorism that's going on in all of those countries, you can see the value of it.
Well, and also, since you mentioned it, and that's what I was going to get at, the central role of Rwanda in all of this, because Paul Kagame is, in effect, a puppet of the United States. Now, he may assert himself against the United States in various ways, but in the larger scheme of things, Paul Kagame is an agent of U.S. power, just as I think Yoweri Museveni in Uganda is, although, again, Uganda and Museveni have been making overtures towards the Chinese in recent years, moving somewhat away from the U.S. So even that is somewhat suspect. But ultimately, Kagame and Museveni have been the sort of strongmen in that region. Remember that Kagame is the one who invaded Rwanda and massacred many, many Hutus, claiming that he was trying to stop a genocide. Now, that whole narrative is much more complicated than that, that we don't have time to go into. But basically, Kagame has been a dictator in Rwanda since 1994. Kagame is also seeking another term illegally, I would add. And there is no real international outcry about Rwanda. Now, the reason why they need Nkurunziza gone, there's a number of them. Now, his policies, I think it's important. He's pursuing a policy of national economic development. He's borrowing a little bit from Eritrea, that demonized country in the Horn of Africa, the Eritrea, which is quote unquote the North Korea of Africa, as they say. But Eritrea has a national service program where people in the country work, whether building schools, building roads, dams, you know, agriculture, whatever. They have this national service program there, mandatory for young people in the country. In Burundi, Nkurunziza has implemented something similar. I believe it's mandatory Saturdays. Okay, so young people in the country, actually not just young people, people in the country, every Saturday working to build schools, build roads, hospitals, and all kinds of other things. Now, this is an aspect of a domestic national economic development outside of the control of the IMF, outside of the control of the World Bank, outside of the diktats of Washington. This is what really frightens the strategists and the think tank wonks and the policy people in Washington. They fear leaders with solid base of popular support who are doing things like national development. And I think, again, I mean, Nkurunziza is in many ways following in a very rich tradition in Africa, whether Gaddafi or Nasser or Sankara or Lumumba or whomever. And I'm not suggesting that we put him in the pantheon with those, you know, historical leaders, but I am saying that there is a precedent for independent development in Africa. That's what Nkurunziza's pursuing. Now, there's another element to this, though, that people need to be aware of. Nkurunziza figured centrally in what was exposed as an assassination plot by Paul Kagame and the Rwandan government against the government in Tanzania, the previous president of Tanzania, who was considered close to the Chinese, who was considered a reformer, a progressive. Now, Kagame wanted him assassinated. And apparently, this is the story that we're hearing from the region, and I've heard this from two different independent sources, so, you know, I'm relaying this information. The story is that Nkurunziza refused to be part of any assassination plot against the president of Tanzania, and instead he revealed it to the president of Tanzania, who then went after Kagame and Rwanda, and that's what created the most recent row between those two countries. It had to do with Nkurunziza revealing an assassination plot. Ever since then, Kagame and Rwanda has wanted to destroy Nkurunziza as best they can. Now, I would turn to an article in, I believe, Reuters just yesterday about what's happening in Burundi. And one of the articles, or one of the paragraphs in the article talks, and I don't have it in front of me. I'll put it up in an article I'll be writing on this soon, that Rwanda has been training a mercenary force and recruiting mercenary soldiers from the Burundian refugee camps inside of Rwanda in order to create a mercenary force to go back into Burundi to challenge the military and to challenge the government. Now, the reason I bring that up, and Don, I know you know this, the reason I bring that up, that is exactly what Rwanda has done to the Congo, to the Democratic Republic of Congo. In other words, construct a mercenary force in the case of the Congo, M23 and a bunch of other groups sponsored by the Rwandan military and the Rwandan government for the purposes of causing civil war and unrest so that Rwanda can capitalize on it. In the case of Congo, it has to do with minerals and economic interests and political interests. In the case of Uganda, of Burundi, very similar. I think that there is a, you know, sort of a two-tiered analysis here. On the one hand, the U.S. and the global imperial designs for Burundi, for the Great Lakes region. On the other hand, the regional geopolitics and the power plays by Kagame and by Museveni that have really drawn the conflict to this point. Now, we hear that there are dead bodies in the streets every morning. We hear of atrocities, all of these things. They're trying to blame it all on a militia controlled by Nkurunziza. My question would be, how do we know that those killings are being carried out by them? How do we know that this is not a mercenary death squad being run by Kagame for the purposes of overthrowing the Nkurunziza government? Moreover, how do we know that this is not directly connected to those militias over the border in Congo? All of these countries, all of these borders are right next to each other. All of these groups are within, you know, a short driving distance of each other. Very hard for me to believe that the violence in Burundi is entirely being carried out by militias loyal to Nkurunziza. I find that very unlikely.
You know, the U.S. government's collusion with Rwanda extends certainly to domestic opposition to Kagame as well. If you're looking at the case of Dr. Munyakazi, for example.
Exactly, yep.
People that want some really good background material on this entire part of Africa, this entire region of Africa, Keith Harmon Snow.
Keith is a good friend of mine.
And mine, too. In fact, I went to Tripoli with him.
Yeah, Keith is a good guy.
Yep. ConsciousBeingAlliance.com is his website. And there's
also Ann Garrison is good on
Ann
this.
Ann Garrison out in the Bay Area, I think she
yeah.
is, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
And John Philpott, who I interviewed. If you want to hear interesting, not that I'm trying to plug anything here, but if you go on my website, or actually just Google my last name, Draetzer, plus John Philpott. Okay, John Philpott was a lawyer for the Hutu defendants for many years since the genocide, quote unquote genocide, in Rwanda. He has been defending the Hutus against spurious allegations carried out against them. He's one of the best analysts and experts on that region that I know. He has many contacts in the region. I interviewed him the day of the coup. The attempted coup against Nkurunziza. It just so happened I had an interview scheduled with him for that day. Interestingly enough, that coup, which failed, which Nkurunziza defeated and stayed in power, that coup is in many ways the precursor to everything that's happening now. And I think that this is part of the reason why this mercenary force is being organized. It's being organized because the imperialists and Kagame cannot count on the Ugandan military. They already tried the military coup and it failed. So now they have to go to the secondary option, which seems to be some kind of mercenary force and or death squad.
Now, if you look at that model and lay it across Africa, and look at Boko Haram and look at, you know, all of the groups in Kenya and everywhere else where you have the same scenario, and even expand it out to places like Syria. And then imagine that the government, the military of all of these countries, of 35 of them at least, have direct ties to the U.S. military through AFRICOM. So that even if you have a legitimate effort on the part of the national government to contain the insurgency that's being stirred up by, in my opinion, American proxies, you also have the U.S. military on the other side looking at what the response is going to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, remember that AFRICOM does not require direct basing rights in order to be able to exert influence in a particular country or in a particular region. The United States has a massive surveillance architecture of drones. It has a military presence, but they don't call them bases in many, many countries all throughout Africa, including, you know, so-called non-military technical facilities and quote-unquote forward operating facilities and all of the other euphemisms they use to not use the words military base. But ultimately, yes, AFRICOM has a major footprint on the continent, despite the fact that they don't have formal basing rights. There's really only two countries in all of Africa that are truly independent of AFRICOM, and that's Eritrea and Zimbabwe, two countries that are probably the most demonized of any countries in Africa, two of the most demonized in the world, in fact. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right. And ultimately, this has to do with global geopolitical political interests, because Burundi is, you know, more or less untapped for its mineral wealth. Obviously, the Chinese would like to get a piece of that, just like they'd like to get a piece of the mineral wealth of much of Africa in terms of their development strategy. In my opinion, China does it in a far less exploitative way than Western corporations do it. I mean, I've compared Chinese mining operations to Canadian mining operations, and they're certainly not the same, because the Canadians don't build any roads, they don't build any schools, they don't do any of the other things that the Chinese do, but maybe that's a conversation for another day. Ultimately, that's what this is about. Nkurunziza is, in many ways, I think, a model African leader among, you know, maybe one or two others. Nkurunziza has been doing something that I under the radar that I think is very important. He is trying desperately to develop Burundi on a national course of economic development. Now, say what you will about Eritrea, but that's precisely the course that Eritrea has taken for more than a decade now. Now, they talk about, you know, slave labor and human rights abuses and all of these other things in Eritrea. Much of that concocted and distorted propaganda, just as we have about North Korea, just as we have about a lot of places. But what they can't ignore is the fact that Eritrea is the only country in all of Africa that reached its UN Millennium Development Goals, the only country to, you know, eradicate AIDS, to really address malaria, you know, vaccinations, agricultural extreme development, poverty, highways, all of these things that are happening in Eritrea. I would bet you Nkurunziza in Burundi is looking at that, and then he's looking at other devastated countries like Congo, and he says, well, wait a second, we need to really have a discussion about what is the best course of action for this country. That is what makes Nkurunziza dangerous, because he is following much more in the path of Thomas Sankara than he is in the path of, you know, some U.S. proxy. And that's why the NGO machine is being rolled out. If you look at Amnesty International's report, you look at all these things, it's just like with Syria. It's based on very, very skewed, very biased, secondhand testimony from God knows who with whatever agendas they may have. This is standard operating procedure for Amnesty International. They are, in effect, the human rights flank or the left flank of the empire. That's what they're doing in Burundi. And now if you read the reports, if you read the articles, all of them talk about intervention. Now the watchword is African Union intervention in Burundi, military intervention, removal of the government, etc. Now, that should sound very familiar to people who have been following all of these things surrounding Libya and everything that's happened after. This kind of military intervention can lead to disastrous consequences for the entire region.
And, of course, having the African Union act as a proxy for Western imperialism would have been inconceivable without taking out Gaddafi.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know, I've had discussions with people about the African Union. I'm not saying the African Union's all bad. I think that there are positive elements to it, especially when the African Union really acts independent of the diktats of Washington, which every once in a while it does. Certain regional groupings in Africa, such as, you know, the SADC, the South African Development Community, currently led by Mugabe from Zimbabwe, you know, the East African Development Community as well. These regional groupings and then the African Union as a whole, they have some positive features, but ultimately they are tools of imperialism. They are tools of the imperialist ruling class. And the danger is that they are used to execute the U.S.-NATO agenda. And ultimately it seems that that's what they're doing in Burundi.
And that's a strategy that you can see being played globally. For example, with the attempted coup that keeps unfolding in Brazil, inside the BRICS structures, with the heavy support for the right wing in both Venezuela and Argentina, you can see the same thing there. Because of the independent structures that have been developed, you suddenly have a Trojan horse.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, again, I mean, the Chinese are, this is not lost on the Chinese. I think they understand this perfectly. They know what the U.S. strategy is. They know what they're trying to do. And the Chinese have been countering that. They've been countering it in Ethiopia with massive economic investment, development deals, and so forth. But again, in Ethiopia, just as in Burundi, the United States can always play the trump card, and that is the destabilization of the government. In Ethiopia, for instance, the government has been not cohesive since the death of Meles Zenawi. There are rumblings from Addis Ababa that there are internal divisions in that government which could lead to its collapse. Certainly, the crackdown on the Oromo people, the Oromo protest, that's a major ethnic group in Ethiopia. The crackdown against the Oromo people has elicited international outcry, and it certainly has once again made the Ethiopian government look like the repressive dictatorship that it mostly is. And so, you know, in Nigeria, we've talked about something quite similar as well. And so, you know, again, I mean, there is a model that these African countries are following, and that model has very much to do with imperial designs for the region.
Now, let's blow this out a little bit.
And I know we're running out of time. We wanted to get to Latin America and Venezuela.
Yeah, but this is something worth exploring, and it's applicable to Latin America as well. Let's say heavy Chinese investment in Ethiopia, and as it, you know, manifests on the ground, and the investments become physical material plant. The model of Syria, with the national government facing that kind of chaos to the nth degree, inviting in the Russian military to help defend the Syrian state. China is developing the infrastructure to project power. And what do you think would be the dynamics of, say, an Ethiopian government asking China to come in and help it defend Chinese investment inside Ethiopia?
It would never be allowed by the United States. Syria and Ethiopia are night and day when it comes to, you know, comparing the two. Ethiopia has been a proxy of the United States for a few decades, at least since the fall of the communist dictatorship. So certainly Ethiopia is, unlike Syria, has been very much in the pocket of the United States, deeply entrenched, and not just, you know, collaborating on one or two issues, such as you could maybe say about Hafez Assad or Bashar al-Assad, especially after 9/11. But I mean, Ethiopia has been integral to the entire U.S. strategy. It's one of the reasons why President Obama made a stop in Ethiopia on two separate occasions during his presidency, in order to sort of underscore the importance of Ethiopia to the U.S. So, and because of the precarious situation of the Ethiopian government, one that is barely cohesive, one that is deeply, I think, you know, rife with internal divisions, I think it's far more likely that the U.S. would simply collapse the Ethiopian government rather than allow it to invite in the Chinese. Now, again, you have to integrate into that the understanding that the Chinese have now moved into Djibouti, right next door to Ethiopia and Eritrea. Djibouti, which has housed Camp Lemoneer, the main U.S. military AFRICOM base on the continent, one of the central drone bases that the U.S. uses for launching drones into the Arabian Peninsula and into the Persian Gulf. That Camp Lemoneer is now going to be joined by another facility, basically within, you know, a short drive, that is going to be controlled by the Chinese. Now, the Chinese making a military move into Djibouti means the Chinese have recognized that they will need to use military force in order to control, if not control, but counteract what the U.S. wants to do in the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. Now, the Bab al-Mandeb Strait is that important waterway that separates the Arabian Peninsula from the Horn of Africa, a massive proportion of world trade. All trade going east out of Africa goes through the Bab al-Mandeb, and the Chinese understand that they cannot allow the U.S. sole control over that very critical global choke point. And so the Chinese have moved into Djibouti. The Chinese are increasing their penetration of Ethiopia. This is part of the reason why you're seeing somewhat of a softening on Eritrea from the European Union, why you're seeing the United States increasingly focusing on East Africa, trying to reassert its position in the Horn of Africa, given that the Chinese are moving in. So I guess in answer to your question, I think that the Ethiopian situation is unstable and shaky enough such that the U.S. would simply collapse the state. Now, let me just also say very quickly, too, Ethiopia is essentially the capital, Addis Ababa, surrounded by extreme poverty of the worst kind. So when we talk about Ethiopia, this massive country with a massive population, there's really two Ethiopias. There's this somewhat modern luxury, you know, capital, Addis Ababa, which looks nice, which attracts tourism and so forth. And then there's the rest of the country, the, you know, 90% of the population that lives outside of Addis Ababa that is living in the most grinding poverty, global south style poverty that you can imagine. No electricity, no access to medical care, no access to clean drinking water, things like this. Ethiopia is a very complicated situation. And so the Chinese move in Ethiopia is obviously jeopardizing the U.S. position.
Without debating further the likelihood in Ethiopia, I agree with what you know with your analysis of it and the layout of the conditions on the ground. But the dynamic itself, and if you know you want to instead talk about Eritrea or Djibouti, fine. But just in principle, as you have governments that are doing business with China increasingly, and as China develops out infrastructure and you know fundamental investment in Africa, and as the U.S. attempts to counter that with terrorism in the way that you know is visible across the continent, there has to be a point in time where there's going to be a stable enough government on the continent to say we need outside help, and since the United States is the adversary and China is heavily invested in our country, we have to look to China. And what do you? How do you think that plays out? And there's well, that's just going to be a jump to Argentina because there's a similar situation developing there, although at a different pace.
Well, I don't think that there's unanimity on the side of the Ethiopian government. Certainly, I think a bunch of them are very much in the pocket of the United States. They see the United States as the, you know, the sugar daddy, so to speak. I think that there are some who believe that they really need to look to China to balance this out, to create a slightly more multi-vector type foreign policy. But ultimately, from everything that I've read, from everything that I know about the situation of the Ethiopian government, it is very, very precarious. The Chinese, I think, understand this. It's part of the reason why they've restrained their investment into Ethiopia. I think they understand that a lot of that investment could be lost overnight if a government collapses and a more pro-U.S. government, which is quite likely, takes its place. So I think that that's really kind of on the in the back of the minds of the Chinese. So certainly, if you had a government that was outwardly pro-Chinese in Ethiopia, it would be a game changer. I mean, it would have a significant impact on the entire Horn of Africa situation. And remember, the U.S. is deeply entrenched in Somalia. So don't forget that the U.S. would have something to say about the situation in Ethiopia using whatever forces it might have there, special forces, CIA, terrorist proxies, and what have you, to infiltrate into Ethiopia if need be. So, you know, at the very least, it's certainly something to watch. Unlike in Latin America, where I think we're quite clear where each government stands as it relates to global imperialism and to the United States specifically.
Okay, so let's go to Argentina. So you have Mauricio Macri elected last month as president, right-wing president. One of the first things that he does is devalue the currency.
Yep.
And one of the impacts of that, of course, aside from the 30-40% inflation that people in Argentina faced almost immediately, is the reduction in the cost of exports from Argentina. In other words, buying Argentinian goods cheaper now. Now, much of that comes to the United States, beef, wine, you know, a whole bunch of agricultural products and others. But the United States, unfortunately for that model, has a bunch of impoverished consumers who are not going to be buying much more, even though it's cheaper. And China, on the other hand, has a 1.5 billion consumers plus who are doing increasingly better every year. So I'm wondering if the net effect of what's happened in Argentina is going to be closer economic ties to China, despite the political implications of that, and perhaps the political desires of the right-wing president, and then the dynamic that that sets in play in Buenos Aires.
It's an interesting question that you raise. I don't know that I have the concrete answer to that. What I will say is, my understanding of it is shipping from Argentina to China is still very difficult until the Nicaragua Canal comes online that would be controlled by, jointly controlled by Nicaragua and China, but really by the Chinese. Until that canal comes online, I think that they're pretty much, you know, subject to whatever the restrictions are with regard to the Panama Canal, which obviously I know it makes shipping very, it can make it very expensive. The taxes, the cost they have to pay to use the canal and so forth. So I don't know how much, in terms of percentages, how much Argentina could really increase its exports to China. I don't know if you have those numbers. I certainly don't. But in theory, what you're saying does certainly make sense. But I do think that ultimately Macri takes his orders from the Chamber of Commerce, from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, from the neoliberal establishment, and from his contacts in Washington and Wall Street. And if, on the one hand, he wants to pursue a rational policy, but on the other hand, he wants to pursue the policy that is approved for him by his masters in the United States. Well, those two things are going to come into conflict because, as you, I think, correctly noted, China is certainly offering a better economic opportunity for a country like Argentina than the United States would. But I don't think that the right-wing neoliberals of South America, particularly of Argentina, are necessarily going to be able to go against their patrons in Washington.
At least as things stand right now. We're getting really close to time here. But
can we do Venezuela real quick?
Yeah,
Venezuela. National Assembly, the right-wing National Assembly takes its seats in just a couple of days on January 5th. In the meantime, Maduro has pushed through a number of very important progressive pieces of progressive legislation, including a ban on GMO seeds and the maintaining the sanctity of indigenous seed production, seed saving, seed development, and also transferring control of land away from private land ownership to public ownership. That means public ownership of the means of agricultural production, very, very important. Also, major development is that the Venezuelan government has now challenged the validity of the results of the election in a couple of key districts, which, if held up by the courts, could mean then that those three representatives of the right wing from those areas are going to be disqualified, which would remove the supermajority from the right-wing opposition. Now, the right wing has said they are not going to honor this decision by the Venezuelan Supreme Court. Now, that sets up a major conflict in about 48 hours when they take their seats between the right wing and the government. If the right wing tries to undermine the very judicial structures and the constitution of the country, this could set up a major political and or social confrontation between these forces. Very important to watch what the United States wants to do in Venezuela ultimately is unseat Maduro, destroy the Bolivarian Revolution, and return Venezuela to its proxy status in relation to the United States. Very key developments to watch in the coming days.
Yeah, and just for our listeners' benefit, what's happened is that there were challenges of election results in many districts. In seven, the government or the socialist candidates sought injunctive relief, and they got it in one, which results in three opposition candidates and one socialist candidate being held out of the National Assembly when it opens on Tuesday, and we'll see how that develops. Eric, a pleasure as always. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Don. Happy New Year. All the best. Talk to you soon.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for joining us for another edition of CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar. Tune in again next week. Thanks for listening.